Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to this episode, number 135 of the Free Cities Podcast. This episode is brought to you, as always, by our most excellent sponsor, Veritas Village. They're building an off-grid village for freedom lovers like yourself in Panama, amongst other places. Energy self-sufficient luxury homes, all in the process of being built right now, and you can own a portion of that if you choose to. They're all close to the beaches and amenities, but in a slightly elevated location, so there is a perfect climate for growing your own food. Every home comes with its own solar system included. You can also get wind because energy independence is one of their goals, paired with a modern luxury lifestyle. Get in touch with them and go and see the project to take a look at the houses currently being built. If you'd like to know more about their ethos as well, click on this link, www.ecovillages.life/freecities. For more info, there's also an interview there I did with Patrick, their founder, at last year's Free Cities Conference, and that will give you a sense of who they are and whether you would like to do business with them. Right, today's show. I am back in New Hampshire, and I'm also back at the Underwoods Off-Grid Homestead. You may well have heard me speaking to former NASA planetary scientist and author Ian Underwood in episode 129. Very interesting one, that. Check it out if you've missed it. This week, I'm talking with his equally fascinating wife, Jody. Now, Jody runs an education nonprofit, so it was inevitable that we ended up talking about education, and in particular, Jody's speciality, homeschooling, in all its myriad contemporary forms. And I learned a new word this week, micro schools. If you don't know what those are, listen on. And you can add that to unschooling, self-directed education, classical charter school education, co-ops, learn everywhere, lots of new ways to homeschool your children. In this conversation, we also talk about the reality of off-grid living and community life in New Hampshire amongst liberty-minded folk. Now, that also includes local government, educational politics. And Jody's fascinating story about the time that a local town meeting was convinced to back a motion that slashed the yearly education budget in half. Basically, because tax is theft, why not? And when I say in half, that's a $1.7 million budget getting slashed to $800,000. What ensued was quite chaotic, and it ended up with the former budget being reinstated on a very small technicality. But what it does do is it gives you a fascinating insight into the incentive models which influence state school programs. Jody's not a fan, as you can imagine. Anyway, many thanks to Jody and Ian for hosting me on their awesome homestead. Hope to see you both again soon. Sometime, right, Noster and Strategic Bitcoin Reserve. And this week I've got a pre-announcement of an announcement, if you like those kind of things. Things are happening over at Fountain, and the Free Cities podcast going forward will be migrating all of our content over to their brand new hosting program, which opens up a ton of new features potentially, including subscriptions, amongst other things, and bonus episodes, etc., etc. Now, I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to play this moving forward. As you know, I've been a fan of Fountain since the start, but especially since their Noster integration. So I'm happy to partner with the project. I just need to work out how to configure the new system. Any suggestions, obviously, greatly received. Send me a message on Noster, or you can do the old-fashioned way, email podcast@free-cities.org. Next week, I'll actually be publishing a huge 3.5-hour interview with the extremely popular guest, Ben Gunn. So I had a thought that I might actually try splitting that episode in half and then offer the second part as a bonus episode for the first week so people can get early access to it, just as an experiment. I mean, I really would like to see this project funded by listeners, and that's not easy. However, Fountain's currently, I think, the best option I have for that. Anyway, it's a work in progress, so please bear with me. But I think already, and I'm looking at it now, you can actually subscribe to this podcast via a button on Fountain now. So please do that if you're a regular listener. And you can just make a small donation each month to help run the show, and that will be greatly appreciated. Many thanks. Okay, right. Strategic Bitcoin Reserve. Thanks for the sats. Goes to Justin Dovidas, and on, user 67BC. Bob, Justin Bianchi. The other Justin says, I'm strongly considering a move to Connecticut. Why aren't all Bitcoiners a part of the Free State Project? Good question. I don't know. I suppose you need to live in America. But also, Connecticut is not New Hampshire, right? No, it's just below. But I suppose the nearer you are to New Hampshire, the better if you're a libertarian. That would be my advice. Anyway, 67BC says, talking also about the Free State Project, is this a Bitcoiner project? No, it's not. But quite a few of the very early adopters of Bitcoin in the States were and are free staters. At least that was my experience traveling around New Hampshire, is I met a ton of Bitcoiners. And a lot of them were extreme OGs, 2013 and beyond. So no, it's not a Bitcoiner project. Yes, it has a lot of Bitcoiners in it, right? Oh, a lot of people also looking forward to the chat I've just had with Ben Gunn starting next week that I mentioned on Nosta. Music to my ears, what a legend. Yes, he is, and yes, it will be. It was a really great conversation. Can't wait to put that one out. Right, time to retreat back into the homestead. I suppose you could always pull up a rocking chair this week. Why don't you grab your favorite pipe? That's what my impression of a homestead is. It's completely wrong. Anyway, whilst you do all that, please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Jody Underwood. It's probably worth mentioning that, actually. I'd like to set the scene before we start speaking, because funnily enough, when I knew I was coming to New Hampshire and it was all kind of free staters and people like that, I assumed everyone was going to be living in places like this. Because that's what I think about, you know, if you're into liberty and freedom, I always associate that with living right down the end of a track in the middle of nowhere. But obviously that's me, and that's not true, and that's not even a useful idea, really. But you have chosen to live, what is it, like a mile and a half into the wilderness? You're already in the wilderness, and then you drive a mile and a half down a snowy track.
If you call wilderness 5 minutes off the highway, then sure, we're in the wilderness.
5 minutes, that's dubious. It took me more than 5 minutes
to get from the highway to the bottom of our road. It's only four miles.
Yeah, but it was. Let me just reestablish. That was single track, snow on the ground, and ice.
No, that's the mile and a half. That's not 5 minutes.
Oh, right.
I mean, from the highway to the turn onto Forehand Road.
Okay, I'm just going to turn you down ever so slightly.
Okay.
Okay. So, do you class that last bit then that we just did? The mile and a half.
Oh, how long does that? Well, when the conditions are perfect, it takes me 5 minutes. But most people take a lot longer than that because I know my road, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually,
how long did it take you to drive up?
Well, I was all right. I mean, I live down the end of a track. So the only thing I was nervous about was the fact that I was in someone else's car, number one. I mean, a hire car, you know. Yeah. And two, I did get out at the very end there and check it, as you saw, because I know from experience that starting hills, is easy. But completing them is difficult. And if you get it wrong, getting out of that situation is even harder. Trying to reverse back down a hill on ice, which it is. It's an icy hill there. Mm-hmm. It's literally my worst nightmare. But right.
Anyway, we are in the middle of nowhere. Yes.
So why is that then? You're a Free Stater through and through, right? You came here because of the Free State Project.
I would say mostly because of the Free State Project. I mean, we heard about the Free State, and you might want us to talk about this on the thing, but...
No, I want to talk about everything, Jody. I think... Okay. I'll tell you now, I've already spoken to a lot of people about the Free State Project, so I'm absolutely happy to go off on any tangent you like.
Great.
You know.
Yeah, but are we recording right now?
Yes, we're recording.
Oh, you said you wanted some background. Okay,
no,
got
no,
it.
No,
I
no,
didn't know.
That's...
Oh, now you're telling me. Okay, now I'm good.
I don't do beginnings and endings. Okay. Well, I do an ending, but anyway, go on.
Okay. I mean, we heard about the Free State Project from in Reason magazine and a long time ago, and we thought to ourselves, wow, what a great idea. One day when we're ready to go on an adventure, let's look at moving there for the Free State Project. And fast forward some good number of years, and that was probably, God, I don't know. I don't remember when it was. But it was after the vote, so we didn't even hear about the Free State Project until the vote, which you've presumably heard about.
Yes, you're just deciding where it was going to be, basically.
Right, which state in the U.S., yes. And so fast forward to, goodness, 2007 or so. No, that's when we moved here. So prior to that, we made friends with a couple of people who, the four of us together decided that they wanted to move to New England. He wanted to ski, live in a large property off grid. And we had sort of three people, like sets of three, had different goals that they wanted to do. So three of us wanted to live off grid in a large property, and three of us wanted to do something with alternative education. So we chose New Hampshire partly because they wanted to move to New England and we wanted to do this adventure thing. And so we just did it.
And where did you come from? Which state?
We lived in Pennsylvania before moving here.
Okay.
But I'm originally from New York City. So wow. Completely different now. Yeah.
That's amazing because New York is the polar opposite of what I'm experiencing here, I would say.
Yeah, for sure.
And even, so someone pointed out the other day, the state motto here is live free or die. The state motto in New York is the Empire State, right? The Empire. And actually, that's very telling. And do you know Melissa Cream? I think you do.
I do.
Yeah, I spoke to her yesterday. She's a New Yorker as well, originally.
Upstate New York, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
But
very different animal.
Yes. Nicer, I think, calmer.
It's very like New Hampshire, actually.
So this is a question that I've been asking a lot of people since I've been here then. When you leave New Hampshire, do you feel that it's different? Like, is it really better here? Is it really, like, and I'm talking about day-to-day things, like generally the people you meet, the police say, the bureaucracy, the this, the that. Is it like, you know, can you tell you're in New Hampshire?
I feel it.
That's what everyone said. I don't know how to quantify that, but a lot of people have said that. I just feel like I'm coming home when I get off the plane or when I blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
There's something very freeing about it. But, you know, I've gone to New York City a number of times from here, and it takes me a minute to, like, readjust my attitude and how, yeah, walking in Manhattan, just how you have to feel all the people around you all the time. I'm not used to that anymore. So there's just a, you know, an overall.
What about the kind of, you know, the day-to-day living? Would it be, if you were in, I mean, you wouldn't be able to live in New York in a place like this, but I don't know. I'll think of somewhere else. Somewhere else, I don't know. Let's go the other end of the spectrum then. Let's go to California, I say. It would be hotter, obviously, but if you were living remotely in California, do you think your day-to-day life would be different?
Oh, so all right, that's a good question. I mean, we lived in suburbs in California, but so you have friends who sort of live in the middle of nowhere. The laws and the people there would make it feel different than here. They're much more restricting. The people are much more, I don't know, woke, for lack of a better word.
No, I think that is the word, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So tell me about this place that you have here then. Did you always live here? So when you came here, You're like me, basically. I like places like this. I'd thrive in places like this. And, you know, I would have done exactly the same thing. I might even have gone even further up the lane or somewhere. I don't know. But tell me a bit about this property and tell me a bit about what you're doing here. Are you running it? So you're obviously off grid, completely off grid. But what about like things like farming and forestry? I don't know. What's going on?
So we own two properties on this road. The first one is where we lived first. And so, you know, when you came up the road, there was that fork. If you'd gone right, that's where we lived first. And we still own that property. And Neil and Emily, the ones we mentioned, they live there and they run a farm. They run a pig farm there, pigs and cows at this point. Some chickens and eggs and things like that. And they've gone through a number of different things. So we get all our meat from there. So from a farming perspective, that works really well for us. When they started having kids, this property became available and we worked out how to get this property. And then Ian and I moved up here. But we lived in the house with them down at the farm.
All right. You both lived in the same. So you moved over here as a group, literally.
We did.
Ah, right. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, we bought the property together. Yeah.
Wow, that must have been interesting. And how many kids were running around during that time?
No kids.
No.
Yeah, so they're 20 years younger than us. And they weren't married when we first came up. They got married in the first year. And we got two piglets I do this. They got two piglets as a gift for their wedding. And we all raised them, you know. And we harvested them at the end of the year. And it's like, wow, that was easy. Let's do that again.
So your Free State experience was kind of an off-grid one. It's like, let's go try and be, were you trying to be self-sufficient at all, or
to whatever extent we could? Sure.
And how's that worked out? Because that's a big question, I think, about when it comes to people that want to live off-grid. When you're sitting on watching YouTube and looking at people who've done it going, that must be amazing, it's all very well, but when you actually come and do it, you can't have a job at the same time, not in my experience, not if you're running a proper farm. It takes up so much of your time, and I think possibly the reality is a lot different to what people expect. How was it for you?
Sure. So I always had that full-time job while other people ran the farm, and that's what allowed us to do this, because I don't think the farm could have supported the mortgage that we have, for example. I retired a little over a year ago, though, and we're doing okay. But, I mean, the interesting thing to me is when people hear that we live off-grid, they say, oh, so you don't have electricity. And it's like, no, we do have electricity. And, you know, we had to make some compromises as we got used to where we were. Look, we're both from city, suburb areas. I mean, Ian's more suburb than me, but he's lived in and around cities, whatever. And so living in the country, living off grid, you know, the self-sufficient idea, we just had to get used to how it works. So minimizing our electric, you know, needs was the first thing. Now that we've upgraded our solar, that's less important, but still important. I mean, we can't just go nuts with electricity. But it's not a hardship. It feels just fine. But right, so that's what people don't understand. We live normal lives, right? We use electricity almost like everybody else does, and water, and you know, we have a great well, so that makes it easy. But you know, who knows what can happen with that?
And what about food and stuff? When you were, apart from meat, have you gone down that route of trying to be, you know, properly self-sufficient, even in vegetables and, you know.
Right. So we have a large garden at the farm, never done it to the point of farming, but mostly, but we also have a short season for that. So, I mean, one of the things I do want to do, and we've been here over 17 years already, we moved in 2007, is to build a greenhouse so that we actually can do more, extend the season and stuff like that. We just haven't done it yet. They're too busy on the farm with their animals. And so that's something that I'm probably going
to
do.
They're running that as a business now?
Correct.
Right. That is useful. How does it work here with, like if you raise animals, can you kill them yourself? Or is there a lot of, like we're not allowed to.
It depends.
Right.
Is the answer. If you're going to, you are allowed to raise animals, quote, for other people, and then slaughter them yourselves and you know, butcher them and then give them to the people that you raised them for. But if you're going to sell parts, like, I mean, ground meat, like a pound of ground beef, then it has to be USDA. Probably both slaughtered and butchered and packaged. Has to be done officially.
That sounds a lot fairer than our system. We don't have any options. You have to register every animal you own. It has to go through. It basically becomes a number in the system and goes through the system. But I've always wanted that version of it back home. You know, it just seems, you know, well, if you go back, even not in that too far into the distant past, when most people had a couple of animals who lived out in the countryside, it is a sign of the times that now, unfortunately, I'm going to say it, the government is basically sticking their nose in your business, even right down the end of a 2-mile track.
Yeah, that's right. There's also limits on the number of chickens you can sell, like raise to sell. There's all sorts of things. There are. It's not perfect.
We've just had a new law in the UK where everyone has to register their chickens now with the government, even if you have two one. And here's the theory behind it, which I can understand. It's quite hard to argue against. If you believe in the state running everything, it's very hard to, because we now have, I think you have it here as well, chicken flu, which is the
avian flu.
Avian flu, yes, right. And
and the price of eggs has gone up.
Not for us.
We've got because you have your own chickens. Eggs.
Yeah. Right. But if the new law is that you have to keep them inside. So, and now you can see why they wanted to register all the animals, I think. And unfortunately, the truth of the matter is, because we had foot and mouth disease a number of years ago. Do you know about that one with cattle, that is? And the strategy for stopping that is literally to cull absolutely everything. So if it arises somewhere on a farm, all the farms around there have all their animals slaughtered instantly and burnt. And people were losing herds that were 100 years old. You know what I mean? Like some farmed herds that have been the same herd for so long. So I don't know. I think you kind of, I don't know. Well, you moved here for to get away from all that stuff, I suppose.
Yeah, we're trying, right? I mean, New Hampshire isn't perfect.
Yeah.
Nor is the US government.
Correct. Right. So, as early movers then, tell me about your experience with the whole project. Is it something you closely monitor or part of, or was it, you know, I've heard from different people, like before I came here, I imagined the Free State Project was going to be this all-encompassing thing. And now you realize there's people that come here, hear about it and come here, but don't really join in. There's people that really join in. There's also subgroups of people. There's now little satellite groups of Free Staters who all believe in the same principles and who all kind of stick together. And, you know, so where do you fall on that spectrum?
I was on the board for a number of years of the FSP organization. That was already a long time ago. And so I was involved in, you know, Porkfest and Liberty Forum and that level of thing. But it was a pretty hands-off thing. I was asked to join and, you know, whatever. They had a slot. But what you've also probably heard is that everybody really we're just residents of the state and we do what we want, what we can, if we're interested. Some people just come and want to raise their families among like-minded people. There's a lot of people like that. Other people run for office and, you know, whether it's local, select board or school board or state level, state rep or senator. I think we have our first senator now who is a Free Stater. Yeah, people get involved at different levels. And, you know, some people are more anarchistic where they don't even want to get involved at the government level. They don't think the laws are the things to do. They just want to do, you know, civ dis and just live the way they want to live. But of course, there are, you know, problems with that. So where do I fall? So I was on the school board for over 12 years.
That's the kind of local school board, as in the old fashioned, nothing to do with the Free State Project.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah, has nothing to do. Right. This is where people just act individually. I was asked if I wanted to join when somebody stepped down or left town or whatever it was. And so I was involved in that local government. It's an elected position. So I, after that first appointment to the end of that year, then I had to run, and nobody ran against me for years. Last time somebody did and they won, and that was that. So 12 plus years, and there was sort of a big deal that happened a year before that 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 made me lose, actually.
I think I know the story. Do you mean something to do with the way it's funded and basically slashing the funds, basically? Yeah. This is fascinating because it really does show you the incentive model at work here. Can you kind of break that whole thing down for me? Because I've heard about it, and I can see exactly why it's happened, but I'd love to hear it from your perspective.
Sure. I'll tell you mine, but I'll also suggest that you talk to Ian about it.
Okay.
Yep. So every year we have what they call a traditional town meeting and traditional annual district meeting. And there are sort of other versions that different towns and cities in the state have. But so basically, we have an election day on a Tuesday in March, which is like next week here. And then the following Saturday, we have these meetings where people get together and vote on things for the town. Budgets, mostly. But it's really all budget related. And so at this particular district meeting, the school board, as usual, put forth the budget for the coming year for the town to vote on. Except this time, one of the residents, who happens to be my husband, and I was chair of the school board at the time, he put a pamphlet out on the registration, the sign-in table, not registration, the sign-in table when people came in. And if they wanted to take one, they could, and they'd have something to read while waiting for the meeting to start. And basically, it laid out why.
There it is. The very same pamphlet.
That's
go on.
Right.
Budget or ransom.
There we go.
Croydon School District meeting. Right. Go on then.
Yep. And so do you know the difference between a budget and a ransom?
Well, I think so. But go on, tell me. I'm probably missing something, aren't I?
No, probably not. I mean, the way our taxes go. So wait, the way budgets go is you have some income and you have expenses that you need to have. And you figure out what you can spend on what and what's important. And you prioritize. And sometimes you don't buy things because you can't afford it. Right. That's a budget. Right. But a ransom is we tell you how much we want. And if you don't give it to us, we're going to hurt you. Right. And
okay,
those are
yeah.
taxes.
Correct.
So it lays that out and explains that in the pamphlet. And then it also explains many reasons why it doesn't matter how much you spend on schools. The outcome's the same. And so there's a chart in there that shows states that spend very little per student and very, you know, a lot per student, and how their achievement levels are basically the same across the board. So it doesn't matter what you spend. So they read this pamphlet, and then it comes down to voting on the budget. And so then Ian gets up and he makes a motion on the floor, and anybody can do this, to change the amount of the budget. Now, this is a bottom line budget, too. So that means that whatever gets passed, that's what the school board gets. They don't have to necessarily spend it on the same line items that they have, like each thing, right? So bottom line.
Quick question. Does it come from the federal government or the local government?
Our property taxes pay for all of it. We get some revenue from the state and some grants and contracts from the federal government, but that's less than 6% federal government for on average across the U.S., like what the schools get, because schools are a local issue. The federal government really has no written powers to do anything with government at the state level. Not government, sorry, with education. I said that wrong. At the state level. And the state provides revenue to the town, so it offsets the cost, but it doesn't change the budget at all, right? And that's called an adequacy grant. So it's supposed to mean that they will provide
the bare minimum, is it?
Well, an adequate education, right. Undefined.
Okay.
Right?
But everyone's quoting a different level. Every state's quoting a different Yeah.
So, of course. And they're doing way more than just the bare minimum. And even, and they're not really measuring what's adequate, right? People graduate, half the country graduates from high school reading at below a sixth grade level. I mean, that's just absurd that they're allowed to do that. And yet nobody seems to care, honestly. And that's something that sort of came out of all of this, even in our small town. Our town has a population of 800 people, by the way. And so at this particular district meeting, what were there, 35 people showed up, and they were the same people that show up every year. And they make the decisions for the town, 35 out of 800. It's crazy. So he makes this motion. So I'm going to pop back to that. And he explained what was explained in the pamphlet for those who didn't read it. And he gave his, you know, little explanation for it. And basically came to the idea that it should cost no more than $10,000 per kid. We have about 80 kids. We actually upped the number a little bit for a little fluff room. There was discussion around the room. The town voted for it.
To go, it can happen that quickly, can it? Someone raises a point and then the end of the meeting,
right.
The budget's, what, how much did it?
So it was $1.7 million to start and it went to $800,000. Right, 54% right. Of the original budget.
And interesting, though, I must ask, the people who were voting to slash the budget, were they people that you knew well? Were they kind of, were they libertarians? Were they, you know, like, what were they just looking at it going, well, hell, if we can halve the budget, this makes a lot of sense. We can put money elsewhere.
Right. So who are these people? So Croydon... Traditionally, I mean, these are people who show up to the town meetings every year. And so I know them from there, mostly. I'm not really like good friends with anybody in town, but everybody's, you know, pretty civilized. And most people that we've met and had any level of conversation with, they're all libertarian, except they don't know the term. And so they don't know the philosophy either, but they do know they want the government out of their pockets and out of their bedrooms, right? Those things they would all agree with until it comes to schools. And then probably half of those people, and maybe probably less than half, but the people show up who have connections to the schools, those with kids or grandkids or teachers themselves or something, they just think differently about how schools are funded. But there's a lot of old timers. There's not a lot of kids, 80 kids out of 800 people, you know. So it's 300 households to put another perspective on that. So more than half, and it was just a majority wins situation at the town meeting. So
that put a lot of people's noses out of shape, as they say.
Yes, and then some people got up and said, "Oh no, this isn't happening." And then, right, so fast forward a couple of months, they found a law, a little known law, but it is a law. They were allowed to redo the meeting for this question, and they regained the $1.7 million budget.
What was that little get out clause then? What was it?
Goodness, you know, it's funny because nobody knew about it. Our business administrator in the district said, you're just going to have to go to court to fight it, that there's no law that says that you can redo the vote. And then somebody found it. I don't even know who found it. But it existed, and that's fine. But then what they did was they did a big smear and fear campaign in town to get everybody afraid of Free Staters and Ian and me in particular. And I mean, they just threw mud. They lied about so many things. You're going to see your taxes go up. And it's like, no, the taxes would go down. Like,
or the money would go elsewhere, presumably. I mean, how much did it save? It was like 800,000. It was halved the budget, would you say?
Pretty much. We can.
So what happens to that? What would have happened to that extra 800?
Oh, anything? Our property taxes would go down. They wouldn't get it. They would, the district would only receive the 800,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
And were there unions involved? Do you have unions here?
Not in our town, but the larger towns. I think if you have under a certain number of teachers, you're not required to have a union. And so we don't. So that wasn't an issue.
So when it was re-voted then, the people that voted in favor of it, what convinced them? What was it about this new finding that meant that they suddenly went, we can't do that? Were their hands tied, or was it more of a kind of opinionated vote?
Do you mean second vote?
The second vote, yeah.
So what happened there was they needed a majority of the registered voters to file a ballot, to actually enter a ballot. So it was a closed ballot session. Often it's just raise your hands or yell. But this was a closed ballot, and then the vote would be valid. So 377 people showed up, so they got their quorum, which honestly to all of us was amazing. We didn't even expect them to get a quorum, but they did. But what nobody reported in the news was that 300 people didn't show up. So those people who wanted the $800,000 budget didn't show up.
It's interesting. And what would that look? What would that budget cut have looked like in real life if it had happened? I mean, even me, I'm thinking, blimey.
What would you do?
What does that mean? Do they get less books and teachers and whatever? I mean, it does seem like either the original budget was a complete scam, or, which it probably was, yeah, that's probably what you're going to tell me, there's going to have to be cut. Would it have resulted in any kind of degradation of the service?
Right. So you're thinking about this as a cut in budget, but Ian's idea was, no, let's start with a bottom-up budget and let's see what we can do with the $800,000 that we're going to get. And so what ended up happening in reality was that the district administrators stepped back and basically said, we have no idea how to handle this. And they used to sit in the front of the room with us in the school board meetings. They moved to sit with the audience after this happened. I mean, so both by stating it and physically, they did all this. And in hindsight, they should have been fired because it is their job to figure out what to do with the budget that the town votes for. But hindsight is always good, right? But when we were there, the school board said, well, if they're not going to do it, we have to. And so then we got ourselves moving and figuring out what we could do. We were, you know, talking to people at the state level and the Department of Ed to advise us on what our options were. And so what we ended up deciding on was having these new things called micro schools, right, that started popping up. They started popping up probably back in 2010, but really surged during the pandemic. And the state was actually supporting micro schools post-pandemic. So this is 2022 this happened, right?
I've never heard that term before. Can you explain what that is? Is that a bunch of people getting together and just employing a teacher?
Basically, yes. Micro school. So you've never heard that? Okay.
No, but I mean, we did a similar. During the first lockdown that we had, we all thought the same thing, and actually, it opened my eyes to the fact that we homeschooled for a year during the pandemic. Actually, was we went away, but that whole thing opened my eyes to the prospect that maybe if I privately funded my kids' education, i.e., found them a teacher and got together with my neighbours, we could give them a phenomenal education for a fraction of the price. It sounds like the same theory here.
That was the same theory. And so the organizations that the state was supporting, one was called Prenda. And what they do is they bring in somebody who isn't a certified teacher necessarily, although we could require them to be certified, but they just knew how to facilitate student learning. And then half the day they would be on computers and moving at their own pace. And then there were projects that they would all do together and things like that. And that's how it would be run. I mean, the town was up in arms about it, those people who were, against the $800,000 budget, the parents in particular. So, that's the general idea behind micro schools. So there's a whole bunch that have popped up that are, there's something called Acton. I said Prenda already. There's Chi Pods. And those are the most famous names, but you can...
How many kids in one of them, for example?
A maximum of like 10.
And do they have a property or do they do it in someone's house or...
You have to give them a place, right? And they would have done it in our school. So that would have been easy. So we only have a K-4 village school is what we call it. And so... it's honestly, we didn't even think about this, but we could have reduced that to K-3 to even have fewer students. But we really have like 25 to 30 kids in those grades. So we could have had a few pods like that. They call them pods, learning pods.
It's a good way to describe them.
Yeah. Although they sound derogatory to call it a pod. So it's turned into that somehow. I don't know why.
Maybe that's because they've been vilified.
Yeah, probably. And then even micro school, I don't like that they use the term school because it's done differently. Again, it's a grassroots thing to do it. So I'm trying to use learning center as the more generic term. And anybody can start a learning center. You have to, in New Hampshire, actually probably anywhere, you have to officially homeschool your kid in order for them to attend these learning centers. That wouldn't have been the case, right, had we done the micro school in our school. There's somebody just in the next town in Newport who she and a friend just started a learning center meant for poorer kids that weren't fitting into the local Newport public schools. And so she has about 15 kids. This is her second year.
How many of those micro schools are just four families getting together and educating their own kids?
So when the families do that, they're called homeschool co-ops. So they're not really hiring somebody to do it. And there's a ton of them. They're uncountable because nobody reports them. They're not like official businesses or anything. But, you know, some families will get, so like the Upper Valley. We live in the Upper Valley of New Hampshire. It's what the region is called. Sunapee to Dartmouth goes into Vermont a little too, actually. They get together weekly or more. They might hire somebody. They have somebody now who teaches both coding skills, like programming, and improv. He teaches an improv class. And so the kids who are interested go to that, and he's hired to do it. Ian and I, my husband and I, also teach a creative writing class this year. We're going to publish a book out of it. Not creative. I keep messing my words up. A short story writing class. And so Ian writes, he's published a number of books, and so he's sort of the expert in that area, and I've done the publishing, so we do this together. And we have about, I don't know, four families, kids who come to this, or five, and it goes up and down each week. So anyway, that's what they do, and we don't even get paid, so they're not hiring us. We do it because we're part of the community, and we just want to contribute. So that's a co-op where, and they'll do fun things too. They'll go to museums, they'll go to parks, they'll go skiing, you know, whatever.
Do the micro schools run as a business then?
They can. Yes, and they generally do. Yeah,
are they an entrepreneurial thing, or are they more of a kind of social thing?
Totally entrepreneurial. Yeah.
Wow. And what about the funding for them then? So if it was 10,000 per child, like, is there any way to get that 10,000 if you want to homeschool your kids?
Right. So.
Because that we can't do that back home either.
Right. So there are these. Things that are running around the country now called education savings accounts. And this is state funded. People call them grants that kids can get. They're around $5,000 each.
Per year.
And they can only be used on approved places, you know, so anybody that you go to. So if it's that micro school or learning center, they have to be approved by the scholarship organization that handles the, in New Hampshire, they're called Education Freedom Accounts, EFAs. Everywhere else, Education Savings Accounts, ESAs. In different states, call them different things. So that's a new thing. But it is, the state pays for this. So this is the government getting more involved in homeschool education. It could be used for private schools too. I want to throw that in.
Kind of paying for it. $5,000 a year doesn't really fund much, does it?
You'd be surprised.
Really?
So homeschool families tend to spend less than $1,000 per year per kid. That's without funding.
Really? Yeah. But what about, what I loved about the realizations I had during the first lockdown were that online I could find very high class, very highly regarded teachers who were prepared to teach groups of people online relatively cheaply, because it's, you know, they make more money than they would being a physical teacher in real life, if you see what I mean, because each student is charged a smaller amount per student, but they get directly all the money pretty much, because it's, you know.
Right, no overhead, yeah.
Pretty much, yeah. And in fact, I told this story to someone the other day. I'm a Bitcoiner. I've been a Bitcoiner for a long time. And the most famous Bitcoiner in existence, a guy called Safety in a Moose, he wrote the Bitcoin Standard, which is the kind of Bible of the Bitcoin world. I started studying with him during the pandemic because I was sitting around thinking, what's going on? No one's doing anything. And I thought online education. And it turns out I could study with the most preeminent person in the field I wanted to study. And it cost, and I did a 10-week course with him for $70. Nice. And they were like, and this was really.
Wait, he didn't charge you Bitcoin, what?
No, you paid in Bitcoin.
Oh, okay.
I paid in Bitcoin back then. I probably ended up paying $500 now. But, you know, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Bitcoiners always do that. Point was that I suddenly realized, oh my God, if I can do that with this, like, imagine if me and five families I knew got together, we could probably hire a very proficient teacher. You know, if we all chipped in like a lot, if we put in 10,000, that's 50,000. That's a, you know, where we live, that's a salary. You could get a full-time, very good teacher to teach very closely with just five of your kids. Anyway, it sent my mind reeling, and I realized that there were much better ways to do it, obviously. So you've obviously discovered this a lot sooner than we did.
Yeah.
But so what's the current situation with micro schools and these kind of the pod ones? What have you decided to call them?
Learning centers.
Learning centers. I'll write that down. What about, so are they flourishing?
They are still growing. They are. And so, I mean, it's interesting. So this is an interesting segue for me. So more and more families are realizing that the schools aren't giving them everything they need, right? So, I mean, I just talk about academic achievement, right? With half the kids not really learning to read. I mean, half the adults in the U.S. read at below a sixth grade level.
How do they quantify that? I hear those kind of stats all the time, and it seems hard to believe.
That's a good question. You know what? I don't know how they measure it. Yeah.
Do you have anecdotal evidence? I mean, I don't know. I thought the way that government schools worked was they quantified results, and if they weren't getting results, then they tried to make them better, right? But that's what
for that last part. Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, but why? But that, what's the point of just seeing schools get worse and not doing something about it? Then that,
because maybe that's not their goal, right? Schools have turned, government schools anyway, have turned into daycare centers more than anything, because working families, right? You got two parents working, they can't, or single parents, or, you know, whatever. What are they going to do with their kids during the day? And so then they've added things on. Like, what's the evolution of schools been, right? It used to be reading and math, and that was it. It's all they did in the original, like, one-room schoolhouses, at least in the U.S. And now they do everything, right? And, you know, there's nothing wrong with learning arts and gym and music, and there's nothing wrong with that, shop and, you know, whatever skills. But why is everybody paying for those things? You know, where I grew up, I didn't grow up with a lot of money. And because my parents didn't have a lot of money, I didn't get to do a bunch of things. It's just how it works, right? It's luck of the draw. I didn't feel entitled that somebody else should be paying for ballet lessons for me or whatever. But today, people do feel entitled that that's what schools offer and that's what they should always offer. So I'll jump back to the Croydon budget thing. We were asking parents about what their priorities were because we needed to figure this out. And hands down, not one of them mentioned better academics, better reading. They wanted extracurriculars. They wanted sports. They wanted job training. Though they didn't say it, they wanted daycare because they wanted to know transportation, who's going to pick them up and drop them off, and, you know, this whole thing. They're just, I don't know, less interested in it. And I can't explain that.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that schooling is changing. And I would say it's not all bad. Because if you look to the schools of the past, they were like production lines to prepare your kids to work in very specific kind of jobs, I think, you know. Whereas these days, a lot of those jobs, I mean, the whole job market's changing, isn't it? The whole of everything's changing. And as a result, your priorities in educating your kids, this is my experience at least, have to be different. And even things like university, for example, when I went to university when I was young, it was an achievement to get to university. It was like, I mean, it was a very small percentage of people that went. And now, large amounts of people go to university. So it's really just further education. So you don't get a benefit necessarily. It's more like keep them in the system, keep the money coming in, keep them to the end.
Well, it is.
You've diluted the levels of achievement, say.
That's exactly right. And I mean, it's interesting why that might have happened. So back when we were in college, what they found was that with a college education, you were more successful than if you didn't have one. So therefore, everybody should go to college. But it's a correlation. It's not a causation. And so now people go to college who aren't really meant for college to learn the things that college are going to teach them. And now, of course, there's a trend going the other way, getting back to the trades and not going to college. So, do you know Mike Rowe? You know who he is, right?
Mike Rowe. Yes.
So he has like a scholarship for people to go learn the trades. So there are, you know, cool things like that going on.
You have that problem here as well, do you? Tradespeople are...
Oh, yeah. It's hard to find them.
And do you find that the tradespeople that do exist are doing very well in life? Are they? They're learning good money.
Some are, some aren't.
Right.
Yeah, that depends on their own. You know what they say about starting a business is just because you have the skills doesn't mean you have the business chops. So you need a team, and not everybody does that. They try to do everything right, so they don't necessarily do it all well, you know, if you will. But yeah, it's just hard to find them, and then they don't show up. They need a scheduler.
Yeah, but that's because it's funny, that isn't it? In my experience. Dealing with builders, it's one of the only businesses I know where they can completely sort of like let you down, but you still kind of have them back. You know what I mean? Like, because they're in such demand, I think, possibly. I mean, that will obviously, the market will change that, presumably over the next few years, because certainly where we live, tradespeople are doing very well. You know, when I was young, the kind of the white collar jobs were what everyone wanted, and the blue collar jobs were less paid. It's now pretty much, you know, what you would pay on a daily basis. I'll give an example. So when I was a journalist in London, I worked for a national newspaper, and I was the chief photographer at a national newspaper. So, and this was in the sort of early 2000s. So I was doing pretty well. And I think my day rate was about £275 a day, right? Now, our plumber gets more than that when he comes round. And at the time, I think a plumber would have been more like £125 a day. So the system has flipped on its head.
Yeah.
And especially because I think most plumbers, most tradespeople are also self-employed.
Yeah.
Self-employed, you make more money when you're self-employed, and if you're a good business person, obviously. But, you know...
Agreed. Their costs have definitely gone up. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and I'd say that's a good thing. I wouldn't say that's a necessarily a bad thing. I say that's a fair thing.
I agree.
So
it's a market thing.
Exactly. Market has. But is it to do with the fact that there's less of them, or is it to do with the fact that the whole world is changing and things are becoming, I don't know, we've got more things that need fixing, right? Haven't we? Like, you know, like I never fix my own car. For example, because I can't. I can now. I've gone back to an older car now. But the one before that used to bleep at me all the time saying something's wrong. And we had to plug it into a computer. And in my local garage said, sorry, mate, I can't fix that. We have to send that to the dealer, you know. So is it that there's less tradespeople, or is it that we've got more stuff that needs specialist fixing, or I don't know.
Wow. Both.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly there's fewer tradespeople, and that's why we need more, right? And I don't know about you, but if I go to a car guy and I don't like how he fixed my car, I'm not going back to him.
Have you got enough choice around here, though?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, goodness, yeah.
But what about, so at these micro schools and learning centers and all this kind of stuff, what are they teaching then? What's the kind of focus of those places? Are those, do they think in a more contemporary way about education?
In the sense that it's individualized learning, yes. The idea is that each kid moves at his own pace to get where he needs to go.
And do you need some kind of what we would call a national curriculum? So when the schools, government schools, have something called a national curriculum. Obviously, if you homeschool, you can do whatever you want. But what do you base homes? What are these, on the whole, what do these micro schools base their learning on? Is it like, right, get them to this level on maths and English or whatever, and then what? see where the kids, you know, what you would call like self-directed education.
Right. Try to find their interests. Exactly. And help them move in those directions and try things that they might like to do, like any homeschool family would. Yeah.
And do you have any idea? I know that homeschoolers always say that their kids are much better than I know that everyone says it. I have an anecdotal evidence of that. My kids, during the pandemic, we went away for a year to escape the lockdowns, you know, and we homeschooled. Really, basically, I just took the school curriculum away with us in a book and thought, right, as long as they get to the end of this by the end of this year, we should be good, because they're probably going to go back to school after this, right? And I did about an hour, me and my wife, we did about an hour a day, if that, and towards the end we would take weeks off, you know. And they did actually end up in, when they went back to school, they were ahead of everyone else.
Because nobody else did that.
Well, this was the kids that actually carried on going to school. This was after the pandemic, so it wasn't, you know.
Okay.
It was simply because, my understanding was, it was simply because I taught them one-on-one. And as a result, we moved fast through the stuff that they could understand, and we never went past the stuff that they didn't understand. So they understood everything by the end of it. Because you know what it's like in a classroom when you've got 25, 30 people. You if they don't all get it, you don't wait for everyone. You just move on. And
That's
half
right.
the time, no one knows what's going on. Whereas when you're dealing with a kid one-on-one, you can tell when it's clicked, and you can and we had this policy where we don't go past this page until you really understand it. Actually, not that you get the question right through kind of guessing or whatever, which is what they do in a lot of schools.
You do.
But you really have to understand what's going on here. And half the time that meant me understanding it as well, because, you know, the other thing I discovered about school was none of it really, well, a lot of it didn't matter.
That's
a lot
right.
of what, even what I was teaching them at age 9, I don't really use that in real life. You know what I mean?
Right. And so if you homeschool, you have the flexibility to do whatever you think your kids need to learn. Boy, there's so many things that you've said there. So first of all, I would start with this. One of the things they do in school is they start you learning to read in first grade. And actually now it's in kindergarten in the US. And a lot of kids just aren't really ready for that. If you're homeschooling or you're in a micro school, they're going to wait till you're ready. They'll do like things to make you ready, you know, make sure you know your letter sounds and make it, you know, even fun. Kids should be playing at that age. Kids really should be spending time with their parents and their families until they're ready to learn to read. And then they should go to school. But nope, we have mandatory schooling starting at 6. So kindergarten is not mandatory here, by the way. And then most homeschool families that I know spend like a maximum of 3 hours a day on school-related stuff. And then there are some that do unschooling, which they don't sit their kids down to learn this stuff. And they pick it up when they need it and when they're ready. John Holt, he's an author that I first found these ideas from. He said, when a kid is ready to learn, it'll take him about 2 weeks. You just give him some feedback. Like, he'll ask you questions like, what does this say? And so on. 2 weeks and he'll be a fluent reader when he's ready. Why push it? Some kids aren't ready until they're 9 or so. And then things like the Waldorf school, this is a private school. They have a different approach to teaching than most schools, even private schools. They wait for a kid to be ready before they actually force them to read. Also, they don't allow them to use any technology. But now I would argue that the level of technology today can really help kids learn individually when they're ready and not move forward until they know. I mean, the thing that, you know, my husband and I have often said, like when you're learning math and you're in school and you get a C, you learn 70% of the stuff. Like, which 30% do you not need to move on to the next piece of material? You know, the mind reels to think about that this is allowable.
Mm. Yes, 100%. And unschooling. I have unschooler friends back home, and they tend to use online platforms, which basically give you a list of things. What do you want to study? And I wholeheartedly agree with that idea. I'll tell you where I find it a bit uncomfortable. So, for example, my daughter, my oldest daughter, is very intelligent. And as a result, school's easy for her. And we speak very candidly about it. And so she's often saying, this is a waste of time. This is crap. Or calculus even. They're doing calculus at aged 11. And I'm looking at it going, what do you think about this? And she's like, you know, how am I going to use this? You know, but, you know. And whereas if you compare that to, so she's a horse rider. If you basically said, right, Alice, you're not going to go to school. Instead, run our stables as a business. You wouldn't see her. She'd be up at 6 a.m. She'd be doing all that stuff. She'd be egging to go. She'd see money coming in. She'd have to do a cost benefit analysis on stuff. She'd have to buy and sell things. She'd, you know, that I know in my heart of hearts would be exactly the way to school her. Mm-hmm. Right. However, this is where I came up with a problem. The problem is, right, so she wants to be a vet. And, you know, I know at 11 you could change your mind, right? But there's only one way to become a vet in the UK, and that is to go through 5 years of further education, even six sometimes. It's one of the most highly contested things you can do. You need more than being a doctor.
Yep, in the US too.
Right, yep. God knows why. So I can't do that for her. You know, because I know that I want her options to stay open, and that my sort of the way I've made peace with it is that we talk about how futile a lot of school is. She understands that. She understands that if she's in a lesson and she's like bored, that's absolutely fine. That doesn't mean anything's wrong. That means they're wrong, but you're actually in this thing and you kind of have to find a way to deal with it.
She has to keep her eye on the prize.
Yeah.
And figure out how to get there.
Well,
it's a good skill to know too, actually.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And I think, I mean, what we've always taught them, and that I think my big realization of being a parent is that the superpower you can give your kids currently is critical thinking. That's all it is. You don't even really need to point them in particular educational directions, because here's another good example, right? So, without prompting at all, my daughter, the same one, put together a book of all the things she knew about horses. So she put it together. So she did word processing. She did, design. She's got books. She worked, you know, and she'll tell you, she'll quote things about veterinary science that I have got no idea, but she's read it and she wants to find it out. I'm not telling her, right, now go and do your veterinary science stuff, you know. But you know, the only way is to go through the system, unfortunately, to do that.
But could she get a homeschooled high school diploma and then go on to college, university, studying the things she needs?
She could. But I think when you look at the cost-benefit analysis of that, going to school is better. Simply because now me and my wife both work, basically. And Liz, my wife, was a mum for the first sort of 8 or 9 years. And then she started her own business because the kids were going to school more. And she personally, she doesn't like teaching. She's not an innate teacher. Whereas I love it, but I can't do it all the time. That's the thing, because I'm the main breadwinner, you know. So when looking at it on paper, the decision is, okay, and the school's great and the bus picks them up from the end of the lane and they've got great friends at school and they're happy at school and, you know. Right. But in all honesty, if I think about it truly, she could be getting a much better education if we were in a different scenario. Yeah.
Right, and if she didn't want to be a veterinarian.
Even then, okay. I would still do the same thing.
Okay.
I would. Well, like, what is it she's learning at school, actually learning that is important at that age? It's really not much, really. What's important is that she likes her friends and she likes hanging out and she loves sports and they all do sport together, which is, and all these things are useful. And I know homeschooling, you could organize your own sport events.
Oh, here you can even take them in the public schools. You can be on the sports teams if you're homeschooling.
Right.
Yeah.
That would be great. We wouldn't be able to do that. I think you're either in or out of the system where we are.
Which is weird because you're paying for the system too. You should get the benefits.
Correct. We are. And in fact, even if you go to private school, you're still paying tax that goes to fund the public school system. What we call the government school is actually, we call it public school. You call it, public school is private school in the UK.
I know that, and God, I don't knows get why. It.
But no, yeah. I don't get it either. I think it goes, there's something historical, you know. What other types of schooling are there now? You've mentioned unschooling, micro schools, learning centres, self-directed education. Like, you run a education non-profit?
I do.
What other kind of versions of this are people trying out, if any?
So charter schools, and that's also publicly funded. That's paid for wholly by the state. And they're all public charter schools. They're supposed to have a different angle than the public schools. Many of them teach classical education, for example. There's a curriculum they follow with Hillsdale College. They do nature, for example, like that might be their focus. They can change, they have flexibility in how they run things.
So they have a charter, which signifies what they believe and what they do.
Correct.
And are they religious schools often or not?
They're not. Actually, as a publicly funded school, I don't think they can be religious.
Right. Yeah. Give me an example of one then. What's their bent? What's their angle?
Oh, I mean, the ones I know mostly in New Hampshire, and they're popping up, is this classical education. Kids wear uniforms. They're just stricter about things. They still have large class sizes. The values that they teach, you know, they're not using DEI,
diversity, equity, inclusion.
Exactly. Yeah. They don't use things like that. The critical CRT, critical race theory stuff. They don't do that stuff. So it's really more about the values that the parents prefer.
It's funny they call it a classical education, isn't it? It's basically what, I don't know how your education was, but that's. And my daughters get the same education pretty much. They wear school uniform. They, you know, I don't know. The DEI stuff does exist, but it's more that it, rather than being taught, it's that you get the odd teacher who likes to talk about it a lot and includes it in their lesson plans and that kind of stuff. And it's not as bad, I think, as I've heard.
It's here.
Yeah. It is here. Is it really that bad?
It's hard to say because it's not in the curricula, you know, like you can't look at the materials and say, oh, here's where they're doing it. But there's evidence can I just say anecdotal? Maybe. That's just diversity, equity, inclusion. I mean, then they have these books that look like pornography books to me in the children's libraries, yeah. You know, which in, you know, in the school libraries, too. That a lot of parents are really not happy with. So this is yet another thing that parents aren't happy with here, right?
It is hard to know, though, because I always think things like that are taken with a pinch of salt because you hear about them on the news, and it is, I've seen that stuff, you know, promoting whatever, certain types of sex in kids' books, which is totally unnecessary. But that might just be one book in one library and, you know.
Oh, there's more than that, but.
So
yeah.
Is it a thing? Is it like, is it really, I know that the education's always leaned a little bit to the left side of the aisle, or not always actually. I mean, obviously these classical schools are, that's why they exist, they're existing. But for certainly since the sort of 60s and 70s, it's been that way, right?
Yeah, leaning more and more. I would agree with that. And that sort of trickled down from the colleges, for whatever reason, because college, you know, schools are meant to feed into colleges. So, you know, it used to be you didn't even need high school if you weren't going to college. And that still makes sense. You know, if you can read, and you should by the time you're done with the fourth or fifth grade, even say eighth grade, you should be able to read and think well enough that you can do whatever you want and go start a job, go do whatever, you know.
Well, the best advert for that is, how much does further education cost you here these days? Hundreds of thousands, right?
Oh, university?
Yeah.
They're ridiculous. The costs have gone up just ridiculously.
The best advertisement to not go is to say, all right, I'll take that 200,000 and start a business.
That's right.
That would be incredible. I mean, that's a lot of money. I know you might not be able to borrow it up front, but going back to something you were saying, when you were talking before about this price per child, so it was 18,000, did you say?
I don't remember saying that, but we'll go with that.
Oh, well, it was something like when it came down to 10, it was almost half.
So. Oh, I see.
That 18,000, say, is there any way as a homeschooler that you can get hold of that?
No.
Is there anyone trying to make that happen?
So first of all, that's just a calculation, right? You got your budget and you got your number of kids. It's the budget that doesn't change. You lose a few kids, that budget stays the same. So the cost per kid is just a calculation. So you can't take it out. It's part of what runs the school, pays the heating bills.
Right. And so you'll never be able to. It's not that there are people trying to, you know, change the rules around that. Apart from, all right, you can get that 5,000.
Exactly. But and that's how people view it. Yeah. That it's their money, and that's why they take it to use it for private schools or micro schools or whatever, or extracurricular things for themselves, or even curriculum that they can purchase with it. Like, you know, anything school related, anything government schools can buy, so can people with these funds, with the EFAs.
But through only certain
approved vendors. That's right.
That's already a red flag. When I hear approved vendor, they normally, I think part of the reason why school, especially further education, became so expensive is because it's kind of, you know, guaranteed. You've got funding coming from government. I mean, that's true, right?
And that's one of the fears. Absolutely. Yeah. That's where it's going to go. And people that say they're feeling it already. These have been around 3 years in New Hampshire, the EFAs. I don't have kids. I don't get them. Those costs are different for me. So I'm not feeling that directly. But the cost of schools will go up to meet whatever that is. If they were charging less before, why wouldn't they charge that full amount? Right. I'm not necessarily against them, by the way, just to, you know, put that out there. And EFAs in New Hampshire right now, there's an income limit that you have to qualify for in order to get it. But there are some bills in the legislature right now that are going for universal, and there are a number of states who have already passed universal ESAs.
So let's say personally, what would you say would be the prime best way? If anyone's listening to this, it could be worldwide, but obviously you're very much related to what's going on in New Hampshire in the States. But if someone was bringing up children now, thinking about the path forward, what would you suggest to them would be the best path forward?
I always start with homeschooling. The best would be the parents guiding their education. Yes. And then if they can't do that, or if they think they can't, a lot of people just don't have the confidence to do that. Oh, I'm not a teacher. It's like, but like you said, you and your wife, you're not a teacher either, but you are a teacher. If you like to teach and you're good at it, you're a teacher, you don't need that certification. But they feel like, a lot of people feel like they need that certification. So I try to encourage them that they don't. Just anecdotally giving stories. Next would be a homeschool co-op, where you actually get together with a few families. And one family who said, there's no way I can homeschool, I live in the middle of nowhere. And she just had no idea that there was a big homeschooling community and in that area. And I suggested this idea of homeschool co-op to her. And she was like, we're allowed to do that? Like, she just didn't know. So the idea for my organization, so we're called Education Options, it's edopt.org. I lost my train of thought.
How do you, I'm trying to get out of you some hard, good quality sort of advice.
Right.
So I'm probably suggesting that, how do your does your nonprofit advise people?
Right. And so that's how we go. And so the thing is that there's so many things that people just don't know, and we want to make sure they learn about all their options. So I start in that direction. Then I go to micro schools. Is there a drop-off near you if you really need a drop-off program? And sometimes there is, you know, and then people look into that and they go down those paths. And you know, even with the co-op person, she's like, and how do I do that? So I sent her to a Facebook group and, you know, told her what to do. And she got 4 responses within a couple of hours of people like right down the road from her. You know, and then I would go to I would try to encourage entrepreneurship too at that level. And then, look, if your kids are already in high school and they just hate it there, then we have a program in New Hampshire called Learn Everywhere. So things that you already do, let's say you're taking flying lessons, because this is actually one that's approved, or martial arts, you can get credit in high school for those things that you don't have to also take it in high school. So that's a program we have. There's dual enrollment in community colleges. So there's a bunch of community colleges in the state that you can take classes either at the college or in your high school and get credit in both. So you're already working towards a college degree while you're in high school, and that just gets you out sooner. So there are things like that. There's, there's apprenticeships, and so there are some organizations. There's some charter schools that actually focus on apprenticeships. So I would point people to those if that's what they were interested in. So getting jobs, actually, right? Starting to figure out what they like to do and learn, you know, on the job skills that way.
My experience was very much that as soon as I tried tapping into the homeschool community, everything was there. But sometimes it's hard to know how to get into that. But fortunately, I have one friend who's very vocal about homeschooling in the UK, and he put me into one Telegram group. And then when we traveled around the world with our family, every new place we went, we just tapped straight into that if we wanted to. And there was a wealth, you know, they're lovely, welcoming people, homeschoolers. I think they all understand that you're all in the same boat. You'll never not get a reply from a homeschool family if you get or on a Facebook group or whatever, you know. I take it's the same around here.
It really is.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I'm looking at the time here. We've been talking more than an hour. Did you know that?
I was wondering, but it went fast.
It has gone fast. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, thanks for spending a bit of time talking about that. I do like the homeschool conversations because like I say, I always feel like I haven't let my kids down. I haven't, but I do know that if I put my mind to it, they could have had like a really exceptionally interesting level of education, because I think most people don't realize it. You know, they don't realize what's out there. They don't realize how good value it is.
That's right.
And
what they can bring to it. Yes, the value they can bring to their kids' education.
Well, yeah. And the truth is, and I know this from experience, that since my kids, the more they go to school, the less they learn from their mum and dad. That's as simple as that. We used to spend all our time together, and now they're learning from their peers.
Right.
And actually, that's where it gets a little bit dodgy, because that's where the critical thinking stuff comes in. If you haven't primed them in critical thinking, by the time they start learning outside the home, you end up with blue hair and strange ideas.
That's very true. Yeah. You don't like blue hair. What?
Well, you know what I mean.
I do. I'm kidding.
I don't mind blue hair. It's just sometimes people with blue, it's a meme, isn't it? If my kids want blue hair, they can go ahead. But anyway, Jody, thanks very much. Thanks for hosting me here as well in this amazing place. And yeah, thanks for spending a bit of time telling us about that.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.